KLYT Broadcast Studios. This is ABQ Connect with Jim Williams.
ABQ Connect is sponsored in part by Bosque Home Services, heating, cooling, plumbing, roofing, and restoration services. 505-444-7200. That's 505-444-7200. Or on the web at HVACAlbuquerqueNM.com. Bosque Home Services, locally grown, locally owned. Thank you for your support of KLYT and our show, ABQ Connect. We're in studio this afternoon with pastor and author Peter Martin. Peter, welcome.
Yeah, thanks, Jim.
And Peter has, I will say, a storied history.
Yeah.
He has been really involved as a pastor at Calvary Christian Fellowship in Tucson, Arizona, with Scott Richards. Scott Richards is regularly teaching, has a teaching program here on KLYT. He's also the author of two books, one Rooted in Sin, Rescued by Love, and the other, his most recent book, The Fellowship of Suffering. He teaches most about issues of Christianity, sexuality, which I don't think a lot of Christians do a great job of covering, so we're going to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah.
And you also talk about trauma and hope. And again, I want to start by saying thank you to you for serving our country. Because
yeah,
not only did you serve our country as a Marine, but you're also now sharing your experiences, which were not all perfect and everything was together. So, Peter, it's great to have you here with us.
No, it's awesome. Thank you.
Hey, let's start right off the bat and talk to you a little bit about the issues that you teach about and how you've kind of selected those four topics as your primary focus.
Yeah. So, actually, I had no intention of getting into ministry at all. I was planning on doing 20 years in the military, but I did four and realized that was enough. And then I had a plan to maybe go into some sort of a teaching field. I wanted to be like a history teacher or something like that. So I was in college using my GI Bill. But during the time, I was being discipled by my pastor, Bo Ouellette, who's the assistant pastor at Calvary underneath Scott Richards. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I was talking to Bo so much is because his main struggle in the ministry he deals with, Running Light, deals with sexual issues. And that was one of my main issues going back at that time in my life, you know, struggling with pornography and sexual sin. So communicating with him over time made me, and getting plugged into Running Light and plugged into what he was doing with the men's groups, encouraged me to start getting more and more involved. And so slowly I started to help him out with the groups and help him out with certain things that he was doing around town. And then over time, they just asked me to be more and more involved in what was going on. So I became more of a counseling pastor and helping him out in the student ministry. And I've been with Running Light ever since. But that was like the first ministry I ever got into.
Peter, you're very open already. We have just met about sexual sin and things that were affecting your life and really taking you captive. Is this something that men can be freed of if they just bring forward the sin and confess their sin?
Yeah. So at Running Light, we get our title from Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1 through 2. It says, "Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us cast off all the sin and all the weight that so easily entangles us, looking unto Christ, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set out before him endured the cross, despising the shame." So we get that idea of the author of Hebrews is producing for us a metaphor of running a marathon. And he's saying we're going after Jesus, we're going after Christ, and we want to do everything we can in our power to be able to pursue him with joy and pleasure and definitely fervor and zealousness. And that means that we need to look at our lives and see, what are the things that are weighing me down? What are the things that are preventing me from running fully? And sexual sin is definitely on that list. And so what we teach in Running Light is that absolutely the thing that holds us most down when it comes to any particular sin, especially this one, would be secrecy and fear. So we need to have a level of faith and acceptance within God. But if we feel this overwhelming shame and isolation from our sin, that's what's going to most keep us away from the resources that God has for us. And so we teach men to produce, and women, to produce a culture of accountability and confession that helps them deal with their issues. And I've seen it go all ways. Some guys, when they come in, it's like any other sin. When they start dealing with it and really wrestling with it in a serious way, I see a lot of them come out of it, and they don't really struggle with it that much anymore. I see other guys where it becomes a consistent battle in their life, where they just have to consistently confess and to struggle against it. And they'll have good days and bad days. And I'm kind of in that latter category where I've been fighting this thing pretty seriously since I was 22. Now I'm 31, so it's been about 9 years. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I have good times and bad times, but the struggle is very much a part of my life. It's something that I'm thankful my wife is with me on. She understands that I have this struggle. She talks to me about it, and I have a lot of accountabilities in my life, accountability partners in my life that also help me with this struggle.
Is there anything you can do because of these little computers that we all carry around with us? Is there any way to protect ourselves from just the easy access that porn has seemed to present it to all of us now?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the main problems that we have inside of our culture is not just the acceptableness of porn, where it's one of these widespread things that's very, very accepted. I think the last study that was done saw about two-thirds of all men view pornography on a semi-regular basis. That's pretty large.
That's large.
And one-third of all women, so that's pretty large too.
And that's growing.
Right, and it's growing all the time, for sure. And especially during the pandemic, we saw a huge number growth during the pandemic because people being at home, not having much to do. It's definitely, that old saying is true, idle hands are the devil's playthings. Yeah. But at any rate, the basically acceptance in our society has become a huge problem, but also, as you put it, the accessibility, where it's a highly accessible product now. It used to be you had to go down to the corner store or whatever and go to the adult store, which was a little shady and it was a lot of shame, and you had to buy something and bring it home. Now you can just access it wherever you are. No one has to know, so it's a very secretive sin for those reasons. There's no real trail. It's pretty easy to hide from large portions of people, which is why you're seeing a lot of even ministers struggling with it on a pretty regular basis. And the best thing that we can do is to utilize something that Jesus taught us. We call it amputation because we pull it from Matthew chapter 5, verse 28, where Jesus says, if your right hand causes you sin, cut it off and cast it from you. For it is better for you to enter into heaven maimed than into hell whole. Now, we certainly don't mean that Jesus expects us to physically maim ourselves. It seems that he's using a hyperbolic statement, which he does often. And what he's getting at is he's saying, if there's something in your life that is a huge temptation for you, don't think that you're strong enough to resist. Because if the message of Christ was just stop doing it, then he would have said, if your right hand causes you to sin, stop it. You know, stop mm-hmm. using it to sin. Mm-hmm. Just cut it out. But Jesus seems to understand that the pull of sin is pretty intense, and we can't mess around with it. We can't assume that we will be given the power of the Holy Spirit to resist in all circumstances. So Jesus put it this way. He said, don't test the Lord your God. Don't put him to a foolish test. So it's not that God doesn't have the ability to keep us out of temptation, but it's that he doesn't have the we don't have the guarantee. And if we put ourselves in situations in which temptation is going to be prevalent and in which we know we're going to be vulnerable, we can expect to be tempted, and we could also expect that our flesh is very weak and vulnerable to temptations like that. So Jesus gives us the advice of doing radical things in order to distance ourselves from temptation. So one of the ways that you can do that, if you struggle on your phone, if you struggle on your laptop, there are certain apps and softwares that you can download. On my phone, it's like an app, and how it works is that app is always taking pictures, basically. So it's taking random photos of everything I'm doing on my phone, and it's sending it to my accountability partners. Mm-hmm. So if they see stuff that's like, it's a little weird, you know, why are you going over there? They can call me and they can help me out with it. It also has blocking software as well. Put it on your phone, your laptop, your iPad, whatever.
I'm intrigued by your wife's participation in this. And I think there's probably a lot of women that might be listening to the program right now that are hurting over this very issue. What can you say to them?
Yeah, no, it's one of these things where absolutely when I'm dealing with my wife, we've gotten to this place over years of talking and communicating about it. And so she feels a little bit more comfortable with it. But I have to, as a husband, realize that when I view pornography, when I fall on these particular issues, I am sinning primarily against God, Psalm 51, verse 4, against you and you only have I sinned and done this evil in your sight, Lord God. But I'm also, in a very real way, sinning against her, because I'm vows to her. to stay sexually pure for her and only her. So when I fall into these areas, I am sinning very directly against her as well. And because of that, what we encourage couples to understand is that for the wife, it is important for you to be able to contextualize what's going on with your husband. And there are two ways that I think are very important for women to do this. The first one is to depersonalize it. Now, what I mean by that is most women, the way they take it, and men feel the same way given different sins, whether it is physical adultery or the wife complaining about maybe your ability to provide for her, take care of her, protect her, things like that. We can take these sins as being very personal to us. And the way that most women take it is, if I was prettier, if I looked like these women, if I was more sexual, then my husband wouldn't struggle in this way. And what I always show women is in the Bible, that's a very unbiblical framework. It's natural to humanity to think in those terms, but it's a very anti-biblical way to look at things. So in the Bible, there's various passages that say essentially the same thing, but my favorite one is in the book of Proverbs, where it says, "The gates of hell are never full, and neither are the eyes of man ever satisfied." Now, what the Bible is presenting for us is this paradigm where we have to look at it of, we are only designed and created to be fully satisfied by God and his beauty. God is the most beautiful and pleasurable being in the entire universe. If I am not fully satisfied in God, there is no way that any created thing can satisfy that missing piece in me, including my wife, no matter how great she is. And I counsel couples that have incredible marriages. They love one another. They have fun with one another. They have great intimacy with one another. They enjoy one another on every level. However, the husband still struggles. And the reason why is because lust cannot be satisfied through a human being or through anything that you find on this earth. We were designed to be fully satisfied in God. And so for a wife to look at it and say, I shouldn't take this personally, meaning it's not because of a lack in me that my husband is viewing these things or struggling in this way, or a lack in our marriage necessarily, but it's predominantly an issue with a lack in him. So in Proverbs 27, verse 7, another proverb that illustrates this, it says, "To the satisfied soul, you will hate even honey, but to the empty soul, every bitter thing seems sweet." And pornography and sexual sin are bitter things. They're not enjoyable in the way that most people would think of them as, meaning that they're not like these ultimately fulfilling thing. I don't think I've ever met anyone who's found their life satisfaction within pornography. But it is something that provides momentary bliss. And when you are empty, when you don't have anything eternally beneficial, something momentary can seem very, very attractive in those moments of weakness. So you have to understand, the only people who are going to be able to find any measure of true freedom in a way that glorifies God, because there are people who don't view pornography who aren't Christians. But if you want to honor God in your victory and in your freedom, there has to be a victory that comes through ultimate satisfaction within Christ alone. So when wives are able to depersonalize that sin and see, this is an issue between my husband and his creator, that's what's going on right there. There might be issues in our marriage, but those issues, while they might contribute to his problem, that's not his essential problem. His essential problem is between him and God, because even if all those issues cleared up, he would still struggle with lust. That's just a fact. Mm-hmm. Now, once they're able to understand that, then there comes this idea of, can she be a partner in his recovery? Is that something that she can do? And this is up to the woman. It's really not something that you have to do. You're not required as a Christian woman to do this. Your participation could just be, I'm going to pray for my husband. I'm going to lift him up to God, because I know that this is damaging to his relationship with God. I want him to be the man that God intends him to be. And this is sin. And like all other sin, it mars the image of God in his life, and it hurts his relationship with his creator. And I care for my husband, so I'm going to pray for him and call out to God to help him. That could be the fulfillment of your role in this struggle. Other women feel more called to be a more active participant, where they want to be more on top of what their husband's doing. They want to be a part of his accountability circle, and that's totally fine. The only warning that I'll give to most women is in Galatians 6, when it talks about our capacity as Christians to help one another out when it comes to sin and being overtaken in sin, it gives this warning. It says, "Consider yourself, lest you also be tempted." So in other words, if your husband, being a partner with your husband in his struggle is going to be a major issue for you in your insecurities, in your fears, in your anger and bitterness, if it's going to be a humongous obstacle to you in all those areas of your life and it's going to hurt your relationship with God, then what you should do is just say, look, this is your problem with your Lord. I love you. I'm here for you. I'm praying for you. But you need to get the help you need. I want you to talk to the men in your life to bring a community of the church around you in this issue, and I need you to work on this. That's completely fine, and again, it's biblical. If you realize and check yourself and say, this is going to be a huge stumbling block for me to be very connected with my husband's struggle.
Your original plan was to serve in the military and the Marines for 20 years. You served four. I want to know about your experience and how that's kind of set the foundation for what you're doing now in ministry.
So I did 4 years in the Marine Corps. I served in the infantry, and those of you guys who are Marines will know what I'm talking about.
That's first in, last out, guys.
That's right.
That's a scary deal.
So Marines are known for being an invading force. We don't have the numbers like the Army to be what we would call a holding force. So we're always the people who invade an area, and then the Army comes in and supplements us and takes over the area. So my unit was tasked with invading Marja City in Afghanistan in 2010. And our whole mission was to be able to destabilize the Taliban's hold over the poppy fields located in Marja, because a lot of people know this, the Taliban are essentially a cartel. They sell heroin. That's how they make their money. So in Iraq, you have oil fields, and they're trying to control the oil fields. Afghanistan doesn't have that much oil, so they're trying to control the main export from Afghanistan, which is heroin. So we went in there. We destabilized them. I did two tours to the same area. The first one was pretty intense. The second one, not so much, because once we got there, the Taliban had already lost the area, and so they weren't fighting very hard. They were basically just there to prove that they were still there, but they weren't really intent on fighting us the way they were my first deployment. But coming back home and dealing with the effects of trauma in my life, especially in regard to my family, was something that motivated me and spurred me on to understand this topic. And I was really amazed to see how much overlap my studies of sin and sexual issues, as well as addiction problems. I also help a lot of people with addiction behavioral issues at the Salvation Army and the Gospel Rescue Mission and Teen Challenge. But I was amazed to see the overlap between trauma and these other areas. And the way that I started seeing it was kind of really surprising to me. So I read a book called Tribe on Homecoming and Belonging by a guy named Sebastian Younger. He's a wartime journalist. And he wanted to figure out why trauma affects us the way that it does. And he wanted to figure out how we can find a semblance of healing and freedom from it, because he just felt like we weren't doing enough in our country. So he went around the world, and he also studied a lot in history and figured out that most tribalistic nations do not struggle with PTSD the way that we do. In fact, a lot of the countries that he visited, very war-torn countries, didn't even have a word for it. They didn't know what he was talking about when he tried to explain it to them. Israel is another good example. And Israel, even though war is a pretty constant thing within that nation, their military, which is, by the way, a mandatory service military, you have to serve if you live in Israel, they have a less than 1% PTSD rate within their military. To put that in perspective for you, we have over 20%. Of PTSD rate in our military, and less than 1% of our military will ever see any active combat. So he was like, what is with this disparity? What's going on? And he came up with a theory that is validated and substantiated throughout a lot of testing and experimentation done throughout the world across decades of time. And it's not getting a lot of press because we in America don't like what these tests are saying. But essentially what he figured out was that what's essentially wrong with us is not that we don't have enough psychological resources. We have more than anyone else on the planet. The problem is that we don't have enough communal resources. So in other words, he looked at our culture and said our culture is far too individualistic, and we were designed as animals, right? He's an atheist, so he looks at it as us being evolved to develop relationships and kinship with other human beings because we're herd-like. As Christians, we believe the same thing. We just think that we were designed that way, right? We were designed by a creator who is a communal in his nature, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. So it makes sense that he creates man in his image, needing community. that community is not something we just like. Community is something we absolutely need. And in America, we're constantly fighting or bucking against that truth. But if you think about it, it makes a lot of sense. Even in prison environments, what's the worst thing you could do to an inmate? Put him in solitary. That sounds kind of radical, because a lot of us, when we think about what's so bad about prison, it seems like your fellow inmates. But essentially what we found out is that that's not true. Isolation is way worse than being in a position, even a particularly violent or aggressive situation, as long as you have other people around you. And our constant desire to individualize ourselves and to say, like, we don't need other people, that has been incredibly destructive to our souls. It's been destructive to our psyches. And that's why you're seeing an increase of anxiety. I mean, during the lockdowns within the United States, we have seen record numbers of anxiety-based disorders being diagnosed, depression being diagnosed, addictions through the roof, divorces through the roof, teen suicide as at an all-time high, those are radical numbers. And what they're showing is that the people who are like, oh, we'll just shut down, it's not a big deal, they didn't understand that, yeah, that will help when it comes to coronavirus, but what is it going to do to our psyches? And no one thought about the impact, because people don't appreciate the studies that have been done in this area about how much we need community. Now, especially when it comes to traumatic things, most times when people go through something traumatic, their knee-jerk reaction is to isolate. And when we see someone in our lives go through something traumatic, we don't know what to say, and so we give them space. Now, that sounds very common in our country, but that is completely foreign to most cultures throughout the world. Let me give you an example, one that we are probably very familiar with in the Bible. Look in the Bible when people go through extreme loss and see, ask yourself this question, are they ever alone? And the answer is no, they are never alone. Job, immediately when he loses his kids, what happens? His friends come out of their way, spend a week with him, just sitting with him and hearing about his problems. Ruth, her sons die. Immediately, Ruth goes with Naomi, her mother-in-law, and they weep and mourn together. Jesus, when he is at Jairus' house, Jairus loses his daughter. What's the first thing that happens? Mourners come into the house, and they mourn with Jairus and his family. That is completely opposite, right? It's so foreign to us that we miss it. We don't even realize how weird that is. But that is the exact opposite of what happens in America. People go through traumatic experiences and they're distanced from their friends and family. But that's not how it was in most parts of the world. And it's still not how it is in most parts of the world. Trauma invites fellowship. And that's where I got the title of my book from. Philippians chapter 3, verse 10. Paul speaks of losing things and he says, that I may know Christ and the fellowship of his sufferings. So in other words, he thought, through my trauma and loss, I'm being invited closer to Jesus, not being separated further, and I'm getting to know him better. That was Paul's perspective on suffering and trauma. And that is exactly why, even though the ancient church was brutalized and underwent trauma that we can't even comprehend in the United States, what they were going through, they went through all this, and yet they were more, we know from church history, they were more cohesive than we are today, and they were less affected by the trauma that they were undergoing than we are today, even though it was more severe. So we may need to look at the way that we behave and the way that we look at things and say, possibly our perspective is askew. Possibly it's wrong.
Well, looking at best practices and what works in other countries and what works in other states doesn't seem to be part of the political process in our country, which is something we need to change culturally.
Absolutely, because everyone wants the solution.
They do.
And like I said, it fed very well into my studies through addiction and recovery in those ways as well. Let me just give you one, because I find it really fascinating. So they wanted to understand addictive behavior back in the 40s and 50s, so they set up an experiment in which they enabled rodents to be in cages and to receive hits of narcotics. And every one of those cases, the rodents became hopelessly addicted and died. So they came up with a theory, and they said addiction is like a disease. And once you encounter a narcotic, it alters your brain chemistry and you become dependent on it. And it's like a disease. You can't overcome it, essentially. Now, later on in the 70s, no one talks about this experiment. So that experiment that I just referenced is the prevailing way that people understand addiction behavior inside of America. there was an experiment done in the 70s that overturned that, but no one knows about it because it goes out antithetical to what our culture believes about healing and solutions to our problems. But in the 70s, a guy named Dr. Alexander, he reran the test, but he called it Rat Park, and you can look that up. And in Rat Park, same experiment, but they had the rats in a community because he said rodents are communal creatures. You can't isolate them and expect them to act in healthy ways. So he put them in a community, but same thing, two sources of water. One was laced with narcotics. The other was clean. Every single time, only a couple rats would even try the laced water. They would never go back. So then he upped the experiment because some people are like, oh, it's not fair because these other rats had intravenous tubes. They were just trying it. He's like, okay. So he addicted rats specifically to that substance, introduced them into the rat park. Every time they willingly went through withdrawals in order to become a part of the community and sober up. So we have this idea where he's like, it's not that the narcotics aren't addictive. He was never trying to argue that. But the bigger factor that needs to be looked at when it comes to addictive behavior is not the substance, but it's the community surrounding the person. And unfortunately, in the United States, what happens to someone when they struggle with addiction? We lock them in cages. We literally lock them in cages. Then they get out, and now they're branded with a felon status. They can't get jobs. It's hard for them to reconnect with people, and those don't people around them don't trust them anymore. So essentially, we've taken this person and we put them in a cycle of addiction because the one thing they need to recover, community, we've cut them off from. And the only community that they have that they could reaccess would be a community of addicts, people who are not going to encourage them to right behavior, but wrong behavior. And that's why you see people struggle in the cycle that they do. So once again, very reflective of what we see with trauma and how it impacts us.
Pastor and author Peter Martin is on with us this afternoon on ABQ Connect, and he's the author of two books. We're going to come back in a minute and talk about his books, one Rooted in Sin, Rescued by Love, and his latest book, The Fellowship of Suffering. We'll be right back.
Calvary Christian School is now accepting kindergarten through second grade student applications for the fall 21-22 school year. With a strong Christ-based foundation, Calvary Christian School desires to partner with families to grow children in the love of Christ, mentally, physically, spiritually, and socially. The goal is for attendees to be the best taught and best loved students in Albuquerque. Handbook, calendar, and enrollment packet information are available at calvarychurchpreschool.com.
We're called to share our faith, but too often, we lack the confidence. The Billy Graham Evangelistic Association can help. The Christian Life and Witness Course. This 3-hour class can strengthen you as a Christian and give you confidence in sharing the gospel with others. This class is a lead-in to the Franklin Graham Route 66 God Loves You Tour coming this fall. And it's free. The Christian Life and Witness Course. Dates, locations, and more information are at GodLovesYouTour.com.
You're listening to KLYT. Welcome back to ABQ Connect with Jim Williams.
We want to thank Ben Lucero and Indigo Mortgage for supporting the ministry of KLYT and ABQ Connect. Indigo Mortgage, 505-836-5700. That's 505-836-5700 or on the web at indigomortgage.net. Thank you, Indigo Mortgage, for your support of KLYT and ABQ Connect. We are with pastor and author Peter Martin. He is an associate pastor at Calvary Christian Fellowship in Tucson. Our listeners are very familiar with Scott Richards. He's a regular teacher here on KLYT. I do have to tell you something funny, and I told you this before we started. I've known your dad, Doug, since before he was a Christian. And he's been an amazing guy because I've seen the massive success that he's had in radio ministry over the years, and I hope that you'll tell him hello for me, and maybe he'll even listen to the show, and I do see and connect with him occasionally on Facebook, so I appreciate him a lot. You are the author of two books. Tell us about Rooted in Sin, Rescued by Love.
Yeah, so that was the first book I wrote. I didn't even intend to write it as an actual book. I intended to write it as a workbook just for our program at Running Light. But when I finished, my pastor, Bo, was just like, let's publish this. It looks pretty good. Let's do it. So we actually had it published. But the idea behind my book is I was trying to figure out why addiction communication was so prevalent in our society, especially with what I do. Sex addiction is a huge buzzword in our society. And I wanted to figure out why it was being utilized as prevalently as it was. Because as a counselor, I was really, really confused because people were treating sexual addiction, the word sexual addiction, as the same thing as substance addiction, and it's not. So in psychology, there's a distinction between substance addiction and behavioral addiction. Substance addiction is defined by imbibing. You actually have to take it in a substance that is by nature addictive to us. So caffeine's a good example, right? So you become addicted to caffeine, not because of any behavioral thing, but because of the substance itself. You like the substance. And you don't really care how you get it. You get it from soda, you get it from tea, you get it from coffee, but the substance actually has a neuropharmacological effect on your psyche, and that's what addicts you. Behavioral addictions are different. Even though there are things that happen in your brain when you're engaging in a behavior, meaning that you are releasing things like endorphins and you're releasing things like serotonin and dopamine, right? These are narcotic-like chemicals, but they're naturally producing in your mind. They're not something foreign that you're imbibing. Behavioral addictions, the way you diagnose someone with it is you have to see, how is that behavior impacting their life? How often are they doing it? How destructive, right? There's a huge study to figuring out how something is diagnosed as behavioral addiction. And you could be diagnosed with a behavioral addiction towards anything. Mm-hmm. You could have a behavioral addiction of shopping. You could have a behavioral addiction of working out, of eating, right? There, you could literally have a behavioral addiction of anything you can name inside of your life, but it has to follow certain criteria. But what I saw with substance addiction is you don't need to do that. If someone uses meth, they're a meth addict. I don't have to ask questions of like, how much are you using it? How often are you using it, right? It's just, if you use it, even on a semi-regular basis, because of the substance, you are now a meth addict because of what it's doing to you biologically. But what I was seeing is people were self-diagnosing themselves as sex addicts without asking those incredibly important criteria questions. How much am I viewing pornography? How much am I committing adultery, right? How is that affecting my life? How often is it occurring, right? They're not even asking these questions as, I view pornography, therefore I'm a sex addict. Now, the reason why that's so dangerous is because when we use the word sex addict, like I said, there's a pretty heavy criteria to being diagnosed as a sex addict. And if you're just diagnosing yourself because you viewed pornography once, there's a lot of baggage that comes with that self-diagnosis, a lot of baggage. And you have to be cognizant of that and aware of that. And so I see people self-diagnosing and it just ruins their life. And what I was trying to figure out is, why are people obsessively diagnosing themselves? Where did this come from? And I did a lot of research and I actually traced it back to the AA movement. And what happened was in the AA movement, which I like, you know, a lot of my family is involved in the AA movement. I like different aspects of it for sure. There are certain aspects that I struggle with, but a lot of it I do like. Now, one of the main things that they were trying to do is, how do we get people who do not know God and therefore do not understand the word sin to take the issue of alcohol seriously in their lives? And so they co-opted a word, alcoholism, and they used that to help people understand the severity of their behavior so that they would desire equally severe life changes to stop that behavior. That was the idea. Now, because of the success of the AA program, Christians have basically done this with everything. So we've realized we can't reach the world with the word sin. So we have to use different words to get people to care about their issue. And sex addiction is one of them. How do I get someone who doesn't know anything about God, doesn't believe in God, doesn't understand the word sin, how do I get them to care about their sexual behavior? Well, I just slap a title like sex addiction on it, and now they care. The problem is the word sin in your Bible is a very important word. And what it does is it puts you in conflict with your creator. So meaning when I say I sinned, I don't just mean I'm doing something that's not good for me. I mean, I am doing something that is offensive to my maker and has consequences attached to it through his divine and holy wrath that can only be expiated through the cross of Jesus Christ. There's a heavy theology that comes with that word sin. But when we remove ourselves from sin, what's happened is we become, and you could see it, it's not something I have to tell people and they're like, I don't see it. It's very obvious. We've become a self-help culture, including the church, where people are not looking at God as like, I have a debt before my maker. I owe him and I need a savior desperately. Instead, people come to God in the Bible as almost like a self-help program. I have certain things in my life that I like, certain things in my life I don't like so much. So I'm going to come to God, get the sociology and the different types of behavioral modifications I can get from church, become the best me I can, and go out and live my life. But it's not a humble acquisition of faith, meaning it's not me coming to God as a broken sinner. It's me coming to God and looking for just a little extra. I have a pretty good life. I just want a little extra. So my book, Rooted in Sin, Rescued by Love, was to help people understand the importance of this word sin, why it's so vital that we understand what it means as Christians and to use it again, right? To not be afraid of it because it's a very good word. And then to also understand how prevalent our sin issue is. Because again, because we've stopped using the word, we tend to only care about behaviors that are deeply destructive. So like, oh, sexual issues, that's a deeply destructive issue. We need to have programs about it and different resources and groups. But then people struggling with greed and lust and vanity and anxiety and other sin issues that are, and I, by the way, when I say anxiety, being fearful is not a sin, but there are certain fearful tendencies that we can adopt that negate courage and definitely engage us in sinful behavior. But at any rate, there are many different sin behaviors that we all struggle with on a daily basis. But because they don't fit into these larger categories, we don't think we have a problem, which is why I found it so interesting. It's like, why do I have a group that meets at church dealing specifically with sexual issues when the Bible specifically says in James 5:16, confess your sins to one another and pray for one another that they may be healed? Confession ought to be a daily practice for Christians within their relationship with God and the relationship with their church community. But very few Christians ever utilize that. They never do it because as long as it's not a big sin, quote unquote, they don't think it's necessary to fight. But all sins are necessary to fight because all of them are offensive to God and all of them carry consequences. We have to be careful about them. So I try to find the most easy way to define sin, and I take it from the most basic level and I bring it up to the more visible and obvious sins and how God's grace meets us in those struggles and helps us out.
Pastor and author Peter Martin on ABQ Connect. We have a couple more segments with Peter. We'll be right back.
Water break. This is Roger Patterson with a minute of vision for life. My wife's gotten me into the Insanity Max 30 workout routine, and its name declares exactly what it is. Insane. There are certain moves that I can do that I don't mind at all. Then there are those that just hurt and are hard, and I'd love to avoid. Then there's the moment. Well, it's not even a moment. It's 30 seconds on the video that's labeled water break. And I love that part of the workout because there I can stop, get a swig, and kind of catch my breath. In that moment, I'm in my own semi-retreat from the demands of the insane workout. You know, Jesus would often take a water break. He would leave the demands of the moment and get away and pray. How often are you taking a break in your day to pray? 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 6 and 7 says, humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, so that at the proper time He may exalt you, casting all your anxieties on Him because He cares for you.
You've been listening to Roger Patterson, author of A Minute of Vision for Men, a daily devotional available at visionforlife.org.
You're listening to KLYT. Welcome back to ABQ Connect with Jim Williams.
Peter Martin is an associate pastor at Calvary Christian Fellowship in Tucson, Arizona, with Scott Richards. I bring up Scott's name because he is a well-known teacher here on KLYT. Scott's been part of the Bible School of the Air, which we have. His show is called Reason for Hope. Amazing teacher. And you've already described some of the experience and one of the pastors that you've been mentored by and discipled by. Sounds like they've stood by you. I'm really fascinated with how strong your wife is.
Yeah.
And I can't help but want to encourage women that are listening to this program that even if their husbands are not at what I'm going to call an advanced stage of contrition, which is what you are, and you're rejoicing in that weakness, you're trusting God with that. But men that are not there, what do you recommend women do until their husbands get to that point?
So I have to be very careful here because there are degrees that this can occur. So there are certain degrees of sexual sin that are very destructive. And again, this is where that whole sex addict word becomes overused. Mm-hmm. So if a woman was married to someone who is legitimately a sex addict, right? So I've counseled guys where they're viewing pornography for 9 hours a day, every day. that's severe. Mm. That's something where a woman would have to look at that and say, something really radical needs to change quickly, or else maybe there needs to be a separation or even a divorce, because that's how severe it can get. So I know that there's different levels, and that's why I'm trying to utilize terminology as carefully as I can. So don't just treat he views porn, so therefore he's in this category. No, no, no. There's varieties and levels that this can afflict him. So if he's at a level that is he struggles with it, but as you said, he doesn't really seem to take it very seriously. Maybe she's become aware of it through finding out or something like that, or he's told her, but he's just not really doing much about it. One of the things that needs to happen, and wives can do this, and this is unfortunate because most women don't have this ability, and I hate that it's the truth, but it is. When you look at the Bible, the way the church is supposed to function is it's not just supposed to be a place where you go and get the word. Most people look at the church now as going to like the movie theater. You know, you go and you see a show and then you go home. That's not what the church was in the New Testament. The church was actually a governmental authority over the believers' lives. And the church actually had authority to execute disciplinary action over churchgoers. That's why you're supposed to be connected to a church. You're supposed to look up to your elders, trust them, and submit to them. And we get this from varieties of places within the New Testament. I encourage you to read 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, Titus, Hebrews chapter 13, and on I can go. But at any rate, what women can do, if they're in a position where their husbands are like, this is what's going on in my life, and they're just not taking it seriously. If you are connected to your church, which I hope you are, talk to your eldership about it. Talk to your eldership about it. Go to them and say, this is what's going on in my marriage. This is what my husband is doing. I want you to talk to him.
I need to qualify something.
Yeah.
This doesn't mean at your women's Bible study you share this with 10 women in your circle of prayer.
Yeah, no. No, it could look that way.
And I don't want to make fun of people, because the women's fellowships are very, very valuable, as are men's fellowships. But you're actually talking about going to the authority in the church.
That's right. And saying to them, this is what's going on in my marriage. This is what's going on in my life. I want you to please contact my husband and help him out with this issue. Because unfortunately, what a lot of men do is they have this, even, and I'm talking about people who are being sincere. There's a lot of insincerity, and time will tell, right? We're not to prejudge people just because of what we think. Time will tell whether someone is sincere or not. But even people who are very sincere, they have a perspective of sin where it's just kind of like, well, just stop, you know, just stop sinning. So their idea and mentality is, well, I did this and I regret it, but I'm never going to do it again, so why do I need help? The idea in the Bible is, once again, very interesting, and this is something I talk about in my early chapters of the book. The first time the word sin is utilized in the Bible, and it's used this way multiple times, it's not specifically used to describe behavior only. It's actually used to describe a character defect that translates into behavior. So the very first time the word is used is in Genesis chapter 4, and Cain is struggling with the sin of bitterness and wrath towards his brother Abel. God visits Cain prior to him killing his brother, and he says, sin is at your door, and its desire is to rule over you, but you should rule over it. Now, that's radical. God is not saying, hey, you haven't sinned yet, but you might, so you might want to get a handle on this. He's saying sin is almost, he's describing it almost like it's a living thing that has a will to dominate Cain's life. Later on in Romans 7, Paul talks about it in a very similar way. He says, for I want to do what is right, but there is a law of sin alive within me that wills to do what is wrong. So we see again, sin is not just something he's doing. It's something that's in him that has a will that's pulling him away from God. Because of that, what we have to understand is the just stop mentality is foolish. If you are performing behaviors, especially habitual ones, that is not a behavioral, it's not something that can be handled on a simple behavior level. There is an underlying character problem, a deficiency within your soul that has to be course corrected. So in other words, correct character produces correct behavior. You cannot create right behaviors without the initial shift to the character. This is what Jesus told the Pharisees. He says, you're content to just clean the outside of the cup. He says, but clean the inside. Otherwise, the outside will never be truly clean. In other words, if someone handed you a cup and it's shiny and sparkling on the outside, but it's filled with gunk on the inside, are you going to drink out of it? No, I would much rather drink out of a cup that's interior is clean and the exterior is filthy. And that's what Jesus is saying. There has to be something done on the inside. So if husbands are like, ah, oh, you know, it's no big deal. I won't do it ever again. Da, 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 da. They're being very naive. They need help. They need people around them. They need the eldership to be aware of what's going on in their life so that they could come alongside them and pray for them and hold them accountable. Say, hey, have a relationship with us, man. Install this software onto your computer. Make every avenue available to you so that you can not only fight this thing in an exposed way, meaning so that your wife could have peace of mind that you are doing everything you can about this, but to also fight it in a way where you're not alone, where there are people around you praying for you, encouraging you, helping you. This is a church problem because in 1 Corinthians 11, Paul says, if one member suffers, we all suffer. You're a member of the body. If you're hurting, we're all hurting. And we want to come alongside you and help you out. So that would be my first encouragement. If you're not too involved in the church, your husband's never been, I encourage you to talk to some female mentors. You get involved in the church. Talk to some female mentors because you're going to need a godly amount of patience with your husband and wisdom in how to approach it because you're going to want to shift into a nagging demeanor. And what I've seen as a counselor is that this happens for a lot of women. They see their husbands not taking something seriously. And they shift into a nagging demeanor. And hey, as a counselor, I'm never going to say like, hey, you have no right to nag. You have every right to nag, but it's not effective, right? If you want to actually do something effective, nagging will never do it. Because essentially when you nag your husband, it basically shifts his autonomy, meaning that you're not doing something that encourages him and brings him into a position where he feels like he's in control of his life and is going to move forward. You're demasculating him and making him feel like less than and like he can't do anything right. And it's eroding your marriage. So to have a godly amount of patience, to be firm with him and say, hey, your behavior is wrong. I don't support it. You need to do something. And to also have wisdom from your counselors of maybe even enacting different types of consequences within his life. Say, hey, if you're not going to take this seriously, that's okay. Like that's on you. That's between you and God. But if you're going to continue this behavior, if you're going to continue to do these things and move in these directions, you can't expect our relationship to be the way it was. There's going to be things that are going to bring us apart. And if it's severe enough, and this is where you need counseling, you need people around you to give you right because your anger is going to want to move this this bar up too high. But if it's severe enough to say, hey, maybe we need to talk about a trial separation. Maybe we need to get really serious about seeking counseling, about making this right. Because, you know, disciplinary actions like that biblically are utilized even by God to get to help people understand how serious an issue is. Because some people just play it off. They're like, oh, it's no big deal.
You use the word serious. I'm going to say that this is actually enslavement, that you are a slave to whatever the sin is.
That's what Jesus says, right? So if anyone who sins is a slave to sin.
Yeah.
So the way I put it is not all sin is addiction, but all sin is bondage. There's a bondage element to every sin that we perform. And this is what Paul says in Romans 7. The things that I want to do, I don't do them. Things I don't want to do, this is what I practice. That's what we're talking about when we say bondage, enslavement, because you don't want to do it. Now, the alternative, and this is, again, something that a woman could be aware of as well, is that we're talking about a sincere man who actually wants to stop and is finding within himself an inability to do so. So he's wanting to do it, but he finds a weakness within his flesh that is disabling him from doing it, and that's why he needs help. However, if you talk to your husband about it, he's like, so what? You know, and this is very common in the church. Some husbands do not think it's an issue at all. Like, it's not a sin. And they'll even encourage their wives to view pornography with them. They'll encourage them to engage in pornographic things that they've seen and visualize in pornography. Be like, hey, let's do this. Let's do that. Let's dress you up like this, meaning trying to fit her into like a pornographic mold. If that kind of behavior is going on inside of your marriage, that's a little more severe. And that would be something that would immediately signal you to go talk to your eldership and communicate with them about what's going on and how to best set up boundaries within your life. Because you may not be at the level where I would encourage you to separate or even to maybe go down the road of divorce. But you may be at the level where you need to set up some pretty severe boundaries, especially around your sexuality. Because just because you're married does not mean your husband has a right to you sexually.
Yeah.
He doesn't own you in that way. When it comes to 1 Corinthians 7, it talks about husband's body belonging to the wife and the wife's body belonging to the husband. That's a self-assessment, meaning I'm supposed to look at it and say, my body is for my wife. It is not a other assessment. She's not to look at me and be like, you belong to me. That's like slavery. You know, that's not what marriage is. It's a self-assessment. So if your husband's looking and says, your body's mine, you have to give me what I want sexually from you, that's not biblical. That's not what 1 Corinthians 7 is talking about. It's a sacrificial passage where the husband's supposed to look at you and say, my body is for your betterment. How can I help you out?
I guarantee you just freed up a lot of women with that statement.
So.
I mean, you just, you know, you spoke the truth and you gave us a biblical perspective. And I think a lot of women are maybe even experiencing relief as we're talking now. Pastor Peter Martin, he's also an author of two books. When we come back for our last segment with Peter, wish we could spend another 2 hours, but unfortunately we have a time limitation. We're going to talk about your new book, Fellowship of Suffering. We'll be right back.
We're called to share our faith, but too often we lack the confidence. The Billy Graham Evangelistic Association can help. The Christian Life and Witness Course. This 3-hour class can strengthen you as a Christian and give you confidence in sharing the gospel with others. This class is a lead-in to the Franklin Graham Route 66 God Loves You Tour coming this fall. And it's free. The Christian Life and Witness Course. Dates, locations, and more information are at GodLovesYouTour.com.
On KLYT, this is ABQ Connect with Jim Williams.
We are back on ABQ Connect with pastor and author Peter Martin. He has written a couple of different books. We've been talking about Rooted in Sin, Rescued by Love, talking about sexual sin, the effects of trauma, and he talks about in all of his books, Christianity, sexuality, trauma, and the hope that we have in Jesus Christ. Tell us a little bit about the Fellowship of Suffering.
Yeah. So I mentioned it a little bit earlier, but what I really set out to do in this book is I set out to write a book that would help people who have undergone trauma to, first of all, not feel alone, because that's one of the major things that trauma does to us. And when I was quoting Sebastian Younger earlier in his research about tribal communities, that's one of the main things that he brings out, is that in tribal communities, because trauma is so known, meaning that if I grew up back in the day or in a more tribalistic kind of a nation, your laundry's out for everybody to see. Your neighbors are not strangers. You know everybody who lives around you, and they know you. So when something bad happens in your life, everybody is aware of it. Everybody knows about your family history. Everybody knows about what's going on. It's not hidden. And so therefore, there's not even a thought that goes through their brain of, I need to hide this or I need to be ashamed of it, because it's just out for everybody to see anyway. It's kind of like little kids. Little kids aren't ashamed of their nakedness because it's out for everybody to see. They're born naked. You know, that's their normal state. They acquire shame as they grow up. And there's some positives and negatives to that. But with trauma, it works that way. We acquire shame over trauma. It's not something that's natural. Think about little children. Little children don't seem to feel the need to cover up their emotions. Yeah, I've never seen my daughter's like about 14 months old right now. I have never seen her get hurt and try to hide that she's hurt, or try to signify or feel ashamed that she's crying. I've never seen her look at me ashamed and have tears in her eyes. There's just this total innocence and purity within the way that she views things. Shame regarding trauma is something that is acquired culturally. And if you don't understand that you have a community and that God is not ashamed of you, and that we serve the only God ever, right? We serve the true and living God. But no other religion even claims that they have a God who's undergone trauma and suffering. We do. There was a woman named Joanne Terrell, who I quote in my book. But Joanne Terrell was a woman whose mother was murdered in front of her. She had to watch as her mom's boyfriend beat her to death when she was very, very young. And those images haunted her whole life. And it wasn't until later on in her life, when she was studying in seminary and she was studying the cross, and she realized, I serve a God who doesn't just suffer for me. He suffers with me, for he knows what it's like to be beaten to death by someone that should have loved him. And she found this connection with her Savior within her trauma that she never knew she had. And it was through that connection that she was able to find catharsis and healing from the things that had been blocked up in her since she was a little kid. And that isolation, that alienation, that's what produces what we call PTSD. That's what produces all the negative side effects of trauma. And there's numerous ones. Just because you don't have PTSD, don't think that your trauma isn't impacting you. Trauma impacts everybody. It's universal. 1 out of 1 people die, and all of us have things that happen in our lives that are not God's intent. And that's important for us to understand. So we have to realize we're not alone. God has suffered with us and for us. God is going to get us through this. But we also have a community around us that can supplement what we need within this suffering. You're never going to find what you need to recover within impersonal sources. And when I'm talking about impersonal sources, I'm talking about medication. Hey, I'm not against medication. I'm not wholly just saying medication is not good. Christians should be above that. No. Medication can serve a purpose. But just know this. Medication for the mind is the same as medication for the body. Medication for the body does not heal. It abates symptoms while the body heals itself. Medication for the mind does the same thing. It abates mental symptoms of trauma and pain while the mind heals itself, but it doesn't. It does not heal you. So it can be important for a time, but if you become stuck on it, for every one person who needs to be medicated for the rest of their life, there's at least 10 who do not. Mm-hmm. But they've been put on a round of drugs that they'll never be able to get free from, because they don't know how to actually heal from what's going on. Now, again, there's always those exceptions where they'll never fully heal or recover from what's going on mentally, and so they need to be on medication for the rest of their lives. But that's not the ideal. It's not normal. It's not good. It's a last resort, and we shouldn't be reaching for it immediately. The other impersonal solutions would be even going to a counselor. I am a biblical counselor. I love talking to people, but I tell them this all the time. I am here to supplement the healing and the resources that you have within the body of Christ and in your family and friend groups. I am not here to replace them. If you are sharing things with me in these sessions that you have never told anybody, that's okay. But I'm going to help you get to the place where you can tell your family and friends about this, because you don't know me. I'm a total stranger. And that's why we feel so comfortable talking to counselors, because they are total strangers. We don't want our friends and family to know about what's going on in our minds and our hearts. And that is, again, it's alienating us from the number one resource that God has put in front of us to help us heal. So to help you understand you're not alone, to help you begin to open up to your friends and family about what you've gone through, and to equip them to give you the resources necessary to grow and develop within your relationships with them, because they're not mind readers. They don't know what you need, right? You might need space in a certain instance. You need to communicate that. You might need nearness. You need to communicate that. What I found is that I needed all these things for my friends and family, but they didn't know what to do. So they did the wrong things all the time. And I got upset with them. I was like, how could you not know that I need you right now? How could they know, right? They're not in my head. They don't know what I need. I needed to equip them. I needed to help them out. I needed to explain to them what was going on. A lot of times when I would have an outburst of wrath randomly because I was triggered or something happened in my mind, instead of explaining to people what was going on in my head, why I treated them that way, I acted like it didn't happen. I acted like there was no big deal. Yeah. And that made them very on edge around me. They were like, Peter could just blow up at any minute. And it made them feel like, is it my fault? Am I not being loving enough or caring enough? And that's really a negative thing to do with your family. You shouldn't be burdening them like that. They need to understand what's going on in your head so they can help you. And it's also to then equip your friends and family to better become that community that you need to heal. Because we could feel so ill prepared when someone that we know and love is going through something like this. We're just like, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to say. This is to also help you out, to have a good starting point of engaging with your friends and family on the level that they need you to.
Peter Martin's books are Rooted in Sin, Rescued by Love, and The Fellowship of Suffering. He teaches about issues of Christianity, sexuality, trauma, and hope. He's an associate pastor at Calvary Christian Fellowship in Tucson, Arizona. Peter, I wish we had another hour. We've gone through one, and we're all out of time. But I'm going to make sure our listeners know that they can re-listen to this broadcast on abqconnect.online. This broadcast will be archived, and I'm sure that Peter will be available to answer any of your questions if you call the church. And I can tell you right now, you're a young man, and I can see God doing amazing things with you. So thank you for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. It's been awesome.
ABQ Connect is presented by Bosque Heating and Cooling, 505-444-7200. Bosque Heating and Cooling, locally grown, locally owned. ABQ Connect with Jim Williams is a production of KLYT. The views expressed on ABQ Connect do not necessarily reflect the views of staff or management at KLYT. If you missed any or part of today's show, the podcast can be found at abqconnect.online.